Signal Leo, 12-3084. Mr. LeGrand, ready to proceed?
May it please the court. This appeal, and indeed this entire case, is about a seven-month delay between Miguel Perez's first and his follow-up appointments with a hand surgeon. A specialist who diagnosed Mr. Perez with a gaping wound from the web space to the base of his thumb, a collateral ligament tear, and a ulnar deviation of the metacarpophalangeal joint. Now, the prison's medical staff and its only doctor, James Finolio, gave no explanation for the delay. Instead, after Perez finally returned to the hand specialist in December of 2010 and was ordered to receive either a custom-made thermoplast splint or surgery, Dr. Finolio wrapped Perez's hand in an ACE bandage and said, quote, "This is your splint." Now, we've raised a number of issues in our briefs, but our primary point is that Perez's pro se complaint, liberally construed and drawing all reasonable inferences in his favor, states a plausible claim of deliberate indifference against Dr. Finolio and the other medical defendants. And because the complaint isn't facially frivolous or harassing, at minimum, Perez should be given an opportunity to replead against all of the defendants, and we think to do so with the assistance of counsel.
Well, maybe it's secondary, but this retaliation claim that you're talking about, I don't see anything in the district court's ruling that addresses
that. That's right, Your Honor. District court, our contention is the district court completely missed it. It was in a grievance attached to the complaint, and documents attached to the complaint are part of the complaint. And I think this is just a fundamental...
It was in the grievances, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So... Shouldn't that be remanded for the district court to address in the first instance to see if it passes the screening?
That's one option, Your Honor. The question is, does the failure
just
of the district
amend
court
it on just amend the complaint with counsel on remand?
Yes,
if you want to pursue it, you can. So
absolutely, Your Honor, and that's what our sort of fallback position in this entire appeal has been. Is basically this case should be at minimum remanded for this issue of the
I've got to tell you, I find it hard to see the silence on retaliation as an independent error here, given that Mr. Perez is pretty articulate about all this, and he says what his claim is, but that's part of what the process of distilling and amending pleadings is all about.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, Your Honor, and I completely understand the concern about Mr. Perez's ability to articulate his legal theory. He certainly did so with respect to the medical deliberate indifference claim, but if the facts had been developed a little bit more, the court would have become aware of a jailhouse lawyer assisting Mr. Perez with his claims, and so this wasn't necessarily an indication of his own competence. It was an indication of a jailhouse lawyer's ability to articulate the medical deliberate
indifference. Mr. LeGrand, you opened by focusing on the seven-month delay in getting back to Dr. Johnson and his specialty. Are you also reserving, I thought you also wanted to pursue a claim against Nurse Brooks, in essence, for even if she wasn't allowed to suture this gaping wound that prevented Dr. Johnson or his staff from treating it immediately. I thought your argument also was that at least she should have gotten somebody else to suture it immediately, even if she couldn't do it.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think the reason why I led with the seven-month delay is because that's sort of the lens that this case should be viewed through. It's sort of indicative of the type of delay that Mr. Perez experienced during this injury. But, you know, to start with Dr. Finolio, I think the allegations against Dr. Finolio are pretty straightforward, pretty clear, and pretty detailed as well. Finolio initially made a determination that he couldn't diagnose or treat Perez's hand injury, so he said Perez would have to see a hand specialist, an outside surgeon. He didn't stitch the wound. He didn't provide any pain medication.
When did he first see Mr. Perez?
It was the day after the injury.
Okay.
So when Perez first arrived at the infirmary, he saw Nurse Brooks, and Nurse Brooks didn't provide him any medication, didn't stitch the wound. basically put some gauze on his hand to cover up the open wound and said, come back tomorrow. I looked at the calendar, and that the date that the injury occurred was a Sunday. So I'm not quite sure if that's why Dr. Fanolio wasn't available. But this court has said that enjoying the holidays, enjoying the weekends, isn't an excuse for not treating.
But then the doctor did see him the next day and just used an ACE bandage. There was no real splint.
That's right, Your Honor. And that ACE bandage came in December of 2010. So, the next day, all the doctor did was basically say, you have to go see a hand surgeon. So that was it. In May, Dr. Fanolio did not provide any ACE bandage whatsoever. So after Perez is seen for the first time by Dr. Johnson and the hand specialist, and the recommendation is that there might need to be some casting or splint for the thumb injury, but we can't close the wound, we can't heal the injury because it's 5 days old. There's essentially, Perez alleges, no treatment between May and December. Now, if allowed to amend, he would make clear that he was going to see some of the nurses in the infirmary and would occasionally get his bandages replaced, and he was provided by some of the nurses, not Nurse Brooks, so not a defendant here, ibuprofen or Motrin over the course of that 7 months. But Dr. Fanolio never actually treated his injury during the course of that 7 months, and he complained about severe pain, about discomfort, etc., multiple times, and it was only after his grievances were filed that he was returned to the hand specialist. And so the ACE bandage issue came up in December. I think the recommendation is pretty clear. The hand specialist presented two options. One was a thumb splint, a custom-made thermoplast splint, and the second option was surgery. And to be fair, I think the state rightfully pointed out the documents that we've attached to our brief and the hand specialist recommendation suggest, in conjunction with those treatment options, that Perez could try to live with it. But this was December of 2010, so this was 7 months after the initial injury. And if you look at those documents closely, you'll see by this time, or you can infer that the injury had progressively gotten worse. At the initial consultation, the initial visit with the hand specialist, the recommendation was possible splinting or casting. By December 2010, the recommendation became surgery or a custom-made splint, and one of the x-rays had revealed that there was some wear and tear changes in the injury itself.
Saw him, I think, December 6th, and gave him this ACE bandage, and then it was the next month that he filed yet a third grievance asking for that custom splint.
Yes, Your Honor. But again, if we were allowed to replead, Perez would make clear that he was asking for this orally, but over the course of the month before he filed his third grievance.
Speaking of grievances, a number of the defendants, it appears, were processing the grievances, and they're named as defendants. Can you elaborate on what their liability is?
Yes, Your Honor. To be fair and to be frank, we appealed the dismissal of the grievance defendants purely for preservation purposes. We recognize that Perez's allegations are a little bit sparse on the conduct of each of the grievance defendants, and the state rightfully pointed out a body of case law that makes it very difficult to bring a claim like this against grievance defendants or non-medical defendants.
Yeah, it's difficult, but it's not impossible.
Exactly, Your Honor. So, and that's the point. It's difficult, yeah. Not impossible. And in fact, if you read the complaint and the grievances in the light most favorable to Perez, at least one of his grievances and the subsequent appeals was denied while he was still waiting to be returned to the hand specialist. So it was denied. The ultimate appeal was denied in November of 2010, and he had still not returned to the hand specialist until December. And so the question then becomes, did he put those grievance defendants on sufficient notice about the substantial risk of harm, and did those grievance defendants essentially just rubber stamp the medical defendants' judgment?
You've also got, this case may wind up presenting some issues that are in play a little bit concerning the privatization of this healthcare system, because you've got, if I understand this, a public official who is kind of a gatekeeper. Is that right?
That's absolutely right, Your Honor.
And then you've also got Wexford that may have had its own policies that may have affected this. or are there some other issues concerning corporate liability under 1983?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. And we would argue that the complaint as stated now suggests, or it's a reasonable inference, that there was a policy or practice in place, and discovery at least will reveal whether that policy contributed to the constitutional violation.
The policy being that Wexford did not have an on-site doctor at the prison.
Yeah, well, that's one, Your Honor. The other being that Nurse Brooks, for some reason, was not allowed or couldn't stitch Perez's wound because there was no doctor there. And Perez alleges that, Nurse Brooks specifically said, because there's no doctor here, therefore I can't stitch your wound. So I know it's a little bit of a significant inference to make, but I think it's a fair inference in Perez's favor.
Would the other policy have to do with her ability to provide medication when a doctor is not on duty?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's something that the state raised, and I'm happy they did, because if, in fact, she couldn't provide pain medication for an obvious injury, significant pain, that's another policy that we'd have to investigate.
So your position is that Wexford would have to have a policy in place that was unconstitutional in order to be liable in this case?
Or a policy, practice, or a custom that contributed to the constitutional violation. So it's basically a causal element. Is there a policy?
Before you give that away, Judge Tinder and I have had discussions about this issue before, I don't see it cited in your opening brief. I didn't check anything else, but there's a case called Shields against Illinois Department of Corrections from earlier this year, where the issue was raised about whether the Monell policy standard even applies to a corporation. And as you can tell from Shields and Judge Tinder's and my debate about that question and other things, that's a steep hill, but it's there if you choose to climb it. Proving a policy would be the easier way to go, no doubt. but that issue's out there.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll definitely look at Shields.
Now you're into your rebuttal time. Do you want to save some time?
Yes, Your Honor. Unless the court has any questions, I'll reserve time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Ms. Boshi Ansa, did I say that correctly?
Close, Your Honor.
Well, yeah, why don't you tell me what the correct...
May it please the court. Assistant Attorney General Linda Boachi Ansa on behalf of the Illinois Attorney General. We ask this court to affirm the district court's judgment for the following three reasons. First, despite the picture that Perez paints in his brief, the evidence shows that none of the defendants were deliberately indifferent to his serious medical needs.
Well, what meaningful treatment did Nurse Brooks provide to him?
Your Honor, she examined his wound, wrapped it with gauze, and scheduled an appointment with the prison's physician for the following day.
And no pain medication when it was an obviously serious wound?
Your Honor, as some of this court's cases have recognized, a nurse's ability to administer medication without a doctor having examined the inmate first may be limited, but even...
So how can that be decided on the pleadings?
Even assuming that she could, Your Honor, this court's cases have also made clear that medical malpractice, negligence, or even gross negligence are not the same as deliberate indifference.
And how do we tell the difference between those on the pleadings?
We look to the actions that she did take, which were to... which essentially were to ensure that the wound wasn't still bleeding and covered it so that...
So your position is that no discovery was needed. The court could just decide it on the pleadings, that the whole question of whether she had the competence or the authority to provide more care and whether the injury was constitutionally adequate, we don't even get to that because discovery wasn't necessary.
Your Honor, looking to sort of the totality of the inmate's care, and given that she did examine him, and we have to presume that she made a medical judgment about the severity of his injury.
Why do
that
we have to presume good. That on the pleadings? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the absence of...
I mean, I don't see how we avoid remanding this, I've got to tell you, but we've cut you off with questions from the other two reasons you wanted to give us for affirming. So.
That's okay. I'm interested in answering what the court has questions mm-hmm. on. How can we determine that from the pleadings? If you look at cases like Edwards versus Snyder, where there was evidence on the pleadings or just based on the complaint of a medical official deciding that he was too busy celebrating New Year's Eve to provide the inmate with medical care. You know, that's a case where it was dismissed on the pleadings, and this court found that because there was that evidence there, it should be remanded for the medical officials to provide explanations. But in here...
So are you saying that only in that kind of situation should... So only if that's pled can a plaintiff go forward?
Well, I wouldn't say that's the only instance, but that is one instance where a plaintiff could, you know, avoid decision on the pleadings.
Well, yeah. He makes allegations here in his complaint and the various grievances that the wound is still open and that it goes 7 months before he truly gets treatment on it. But that seems to be enough to get by a 1915A screening.
Your Honor, if you look at his grievances and at the documents that he's attached to his complaint and to his appellate brief, the picture is a little different. It's not the case where he, you know, was seen once and completely ignored for 7 months until he received treatment again. What happened is he was examined by the prison's doctor on the day after his injury. The doctor determined at that point that he needed to see an outside specialist, so he saw the outside specialist shortly thereafter. The specialist proposed a number of different options and suggested...
None of which he got.
The immediate response is we can't do anything because his wound is still open and we want to see him next week, and he didn't see him for 7 months.
They wanted to see him next week to do a wound check.
Yeah.
Not necessarily to, you know, suture it or stitch it or anything, but just to do a wound check. And because this is a doctor, Fenoglio is a doctor, the most likely inference is that he decided he was able to care for his wound by himself, rather care for Perez's wound on his own, and that there wasn't a need to go back to the Carl Clinic
What he was doing. So that's the theory. From May 21st till December 6th, he was just taking care of it himself. He was ordered to have twice daily treatment and to have other appointments, but those appointments never happened.
Your Honor, one of his grievances does make clear that Fenoglio was examining him during this time period. I believe it's the January 2011 grievance where he says that, you know, I have been seen by various nurses and Fenoglio up until the point where Fenoglio decided that he should be sent back to the Carl Clinic in December 2010.
So based on that language in the grievance, we should affirm the dismissal?
As well as the documents that they've attached to their pleadings, which show that when he did return to the Carl Clinic, his laceration was well healed. They suggested various options. He suggested various options to help with range of motion. Among them, and actually the first option that they suggested, was for him to try and manage the symptoms, to live with it and see how it goes. Because if they were to do a surgical procedure, that would be the same whether they did it immediately or in a 3-year period. So if you look to...
Well, these are all interesting debates. I don't see how we possibly resolve them on the pleadings, but particularly with a dismissal with prejudice.
This court has suggested, you know, the district court in this case found that Perez had failed to state a claim on which relief can be granted. And this court's decisions say that that dismissal should be with prejudice. Now, we do acknowledge that there is a case from the circuit which says, you know, they should be given an opportunity to replead. But in the cases that we cited in our brief certainly stand for the proposition that dismissal should be with prejudice.
Well, there are cases. I'll tell you, I at the end of the plaintiff's brief, there's a fairly lengthy footnote. Mm-hmm. In essence, noting that the problems with dismissal, sua sponte dismissals with prejudice, noting that, okay, want a prosecution, but facially frivolous or harassing complaints and so on, those we deal with a lot of volume of, as I'm sure your office does, of claims without a whole lot of merit to them, and that fit into the frivolous or harassing category. I don't see how this does.
This was dismissed for failure to state a claim, not for being facially frivolous or harassing.
Are you suggesting we should apply different standards to prison complaints as opposed to just somebody who pays the filing fee?
Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that at all. Okay. Based on this court's precedent, in the cases that we cited, dismissal under the circumstances that we have here should be with prejudice. That's the law in this circuit.
Which cases in particular?
Gladney and McCree.
Okay, thank you.
I'm just curious, is there ever a time when you see in your office a complaint like this filed and see that it's a dismissal without prejudice that you, motion up something before the judge to discuss it? I mean, it just strikes me when you look at the type of injury that was alleged here in the long period, which he did have in his complaint, that he alleged he didn't receive treatment, that there would be some investigation in your office. I mean, I'm not trying to get into your back office decisions, sure, but I'm just curious.
Your Honor, I'm not aware. I'm not aware of that. And although he does allege that he went through this long period without any treatment, again, there's other evidence in the record, including other evidence in his own grievances, which show that he was receiving treatment during this time.
I guess treatment is in the eye of the beholder.
It is, and
because to just let something languish with no real action here, which is, you know, how I read this, the ACE bandage, given the wound and given the extent of the injury, requires more than just an ACE bandage. But
Your Honor, this court has said that an inmate is entitled to adequate medical care. And if you look at the recommendations from the specialists at the Carl Clinic, they suggest among the treatment options to just live with it. So we submit that wrapping his hand with an ACE bandage is at least consistent with the suggestion that he try and just live with it. The evidence also shows that the non-medical defendants checked his medical records to confirm that he was being treated during this time period by the medical staff. And because they had no reason to believe that he was being mistreated, their actions were entirely consistent with the division of labor that this court has described in previous cases. Second, Perez did not raise a claim for retaliation. In general, the complaint has to inform the district court and the other parties of the issues sought to be litigated. And in this case, his complaint focused solely on defendant's treatment of his injured hand. Third, the court did not abuse its discretion by not recruiting an attorney to represent Perez.
Let me go back, though, to the retaliation.
Yes.
Didn't he say in his complaint that his treatment was in retribution? So he doesn't use the word retaliation, but he says in retribution for a past grievance?
That was in a grievance attached to his complaint, not in the complaint itself. And I understand that this court does consider documents attached, but it's still incumbent on the litigant, even a pro se litigant, to state the issues in, you know, the document that's in the statement of the claim, state the issues that he wants to litigate. And in this case, he put together a pretty comprehensible explanation of the claim that he sought to be litigated, which was that defendants improperly, in his view, treated his injured thumb. So with regard, again, to his constitutional claim, the Eighth Amendment imposes on prison officials a duty to ensure that the inmate's receiving adequate medical care. But as this court has observed, there's more than one acceptable way to practice medicine in prison. And we look to the totality of an inmate's care in determining whether that care was deliberately indifferent. Here, even if the defendants didn't respond to his request as quickly as he would have liked or in the manner that he would have preferred, the Eighth Amendment prohibits cruel and unusual punishments. Medical malpractice, negligence, and gross negligence are not the same as deliberate indifference. And his allegations, as well as the documents that he's attached to his pleadings, show that he can't satisfy the high hurdles imposed on claims of deliberate indifference. So to state a claim of deliberate indifference against a doctor, plaintiff's allegations have to show that the doctor's choice of treatment was so far afield of accepted professional standards to raise the inference that it was not based on medical judgment. Here, Perez's allegations show that Fenoglio examined him several times over that 6 or so month period and twice referred him to see an outside hand specialist. Fenoglio's behavior does not show or does not suggest that he disregarded a serious risk to Perez's health and safety. Instead, the documents attached to his filings show that Fenoglio implemented a course of medical treatment that was consistent with what the outside specialist had recommended. And the evidence also suggests that the specialist at the Carl Clinic advised Perez to avoid surgery if he could, so it's inaccurate to suggest that there was a delay in his being operated on. The non-medical defendants, Vaughn, Moran, Riker, Fairchild, and Taylor, were all responsible for reviewing his grievances, and as we explained in our brief, by the time each defendant reviewed his grievance from May of 2010 and his appeal of the denial of that grievance, Perez's records show that he was being treated by medical professionals. Non-medical prison officials are, of course, entitled to rely on the medical professionals to handle the inmate's medical needs, and nothing in the record suggests that he even made a complaint about the type of treatment that he was being given until his grievance from January 2011. And the record doesn't contain a response to that grievance, but shortly after he filed it, he was taken back to the Carl Clinic, and he credits the non-medical officials for ensuring the follow-up appointment. With regard to Martin, although Perez referred to him in the complaint as the liaison between Wexford and the prison, none of his allegations suggest that Martin knew of his injury or of the type of treatment that he was receiving. And the district court properly dismissed him for that reason. Regarding Wexford, Perez's complaint did not identify an unconstitutional policy or practice that it adopted or condoned. On appeal, he argues that Wexford maintained a policy of not having a full-time doctor stationed at the prison, but the Constitution doesn't require specific medical practices. It only requires that the inmate receive adequate care. With regard to the retaliation argument, again, Perez was responsible for giving the defendants fair notice of what his claim was and the grounds on which it rested. And it said nothing about retaliation. This court has ruled that a party's not allowed to add a new legal claim to his complaint on appeal. I see that my time has expired for these reasons and the reasons stated in our brief. Unless this court has further questions, we ask you to affirm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
How much time does he have? 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to start with the retaliation claim, this court has said plenty of times you don't have to plead a legal theory in your complaint. So the facts are sufficient to state a claim, and the facts as attached to his complaint state a retaliation claim. Counsel for the state mentioned Edwards. Edwards v. Snyder, I think, is a case that's just devastating to their side. In that case, in fact, there was a two-hour delay before the prison doctor saw the prisoner, and there was a two-day delay before the prison doctor reset the prisoner's finger and ordered x-rays. In this case, this court let that case go forward. So that kind of delay, provision of some treatment, just isn't enough to screen a complaint on 1958. The state mentioned that Perez was seen by Dr. Fenoglio, and he says that in his complaint. He actually says, I was seen here by Dr. James Fenoglio. After a couple of visits, he referred me back to the Carly Clinic. Read most, with all reasonable inferences in Perez's favor, he says nothing about receiving treatment. He just says he was seen, and in fact, that's what he will reallege if given an opportunity to replead, that he was just seen, and he complained about the pain, complained about needing to go back to the hand specialist. And he only saw him a couple of times, so couple literally meaning two. With regard to dismissal with prejudice, again, I think the cases that the state cites for dismissal with prejudice are all cases in which there are sort of no set of facts that the plaintiff could prove consistent with the allegations and recover on the theories that they allege. That's just not the case here. If, in fact, Perez has alleged negligence, all he needs to do is prove state of mind, and he can recover for deliberate indifference. So dismissal with prejudice just wasn't appropriate here. There was one thing that I neglected to mention, Your Honor, in my opening, and I talked to State's counsel about this before argument. So there are a couple of references in my brief to March 2012 as the date in which Perez received his surgery. In fact, I received a call last night from Perez's wife, and he received that surgery in March 2011. So I need to correct the record on that, and I apologize for that error. Unless the court has any other questions.
Thank you very much. All in all, about 10 months then before he received the surgery.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes,
Your Honor. All right. Is Mr. Perez still in custody?
He is, Your Honor, but he was recently transferred to, I mean, just like a few weeks ago, transferred to a different institution. Okay. And so now he has access to some of the papers that he didn't have access to before. So
that was one of his prayers for relief in his complaint.
Yes, okay. Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. Thank you both counsel for the fine argument. We'll take the case under advisement.